Duda, and she is the respiration ecologist at the Pacific Northwest National Lab at Marine Sciences out of Scrimp, Washington. And since 2000, she's conducted research and restoration in a variety of coastal and riverine ecosystems. And she's currently participating in research and adaptive management for the recovery of endangered species acquisition birds and monitoring the effectiveness of habitat restoration actions. And she did receive her doctorate in 2007 from the University of Washington here in the College of Forest Resources. And she also has a BA in forest ecology at Reed College in Portland. And BA also live a lot from the Evergreen State University, and MA in English from Western Washington University. So she's very well educated. So this morning she's going to tell us about tidal wetland restoration in the lower Columbia River and estuary.
Good morning. Thank you for coming. Can you hear me in the back? Excellent. Well, I understand that the Water Center includes both public policy and affairs and natural science and engineering. So I wanted to talk for the first few minutes here about the context of the research that we've been doing down in the Columbia River, both from an ecological perspective and from a public affairs or public policy perspective. So the first part of the talk then is going to be the contextualizing the research. And then the center part of the talk will be concern the cumulative effects, evaluating the cumulative effects of multiple restoration projects using a levels of evidence approach. And then the final portion of the talk will concern comparing restoration and reference sites. So it'll be a specific study with some results for you. And these photos indicate some of the typical habitat types that we're working with down on the Columbia. So this is a marsh system down that's been, about 65% of this type of marsh has been lost. This is a swamp system, so a forested tidal wetland, of which about 77% has been lost. And then these are some examples of today's land uses. So you see the logging activities in the background and the diked river here, and then the dairy cattle grazing in the foreground. So the study area that I'm talking about today is the Columbia River estuary, which is from the mouth of the river here up to Bonneville Dam. It's actually an artificial delineation. Excuse me. Can you still hear me in the back now? Is that better? Okay. So the river is tidal all the way to Bonneville Dam, and so that is what the action agencies have deemed the estuary, even though it's actually salty only up to about 37 kilometers, which varies tidally and seasonally, the salt intrusion. But this is our study area. It's 235 kilometers long, and the basin, of course, up here comes through a couple of Canadian provinces and five states to cross over the Cascades and through the Willamette Valley and the Puget Trough, where these come together and across the coast ranges. So we're dealing with a very diverse physiographic area. And I know that you here participating in this series are very familiar with the global context of the challenges that we're facing in river management. But specifically, I want to talk a little bit about how the estuary and river issues come together. So nationally, we have programs on all U.S. coasts, major restoration programs on all U.S. coasts in these estuaries, many of which are in the billions of dollars, the Everglades, for example, and the Louisiana wetlands. And on this coast now we have the Puget Sound restoration getting underway, as well as Columbia River, which are much smaller programs in terms of dollar amounts right now, but hopefully will achieve some more momentum in the future. On rivers, some of the major issues that we're dealing with globally are the loss of biodiversity, the loss of lateral connectivity between the main stem and the floodplain, and that's going to be a lot of the focus of my talk today. And some of the concepts that have been advanced to deal with these issues are the environmental flows and pulse concepts from Junk et al. And others. And specifically, my research here in the college concerned floodplain forest coupling. There hasn't been very much research on floodplain forest's effects on hydrogeomorphic processes in the tidal areas of large temperate zone rivers. And as you know, here in the Northwest, we're fortunate to have great study areas that have been lost in most parts of the world that are in the temperate zone. So some of the physical features of this study area are it's a drowned river valley, and its tidal, as I mentioned, and it's second only to the Mississippi in terms of discharge, in terms of large rivers in the United States. The discharge is second only to the Mississippi. It's about 15 kilometers wide here near the mouth, and then 3 kilometers wide at the jetties. And the historical unregulated flows ranged up to 1 million CFS during the spring freshet, so it had a great deal of flow. And the current conditions under the altered hydrograph caused by 30 major dams and diking of the floodplain, so again, breaking up that lateral connectivity between the main stem and the floodplain, have produced a 40% flow reduction and 62% reduction in shallow water habitat for the out-migrating juvenile salmon that use those floodplain habitats to rear. The key habitat restoration drivers fall under the Endangered Species Act. Particularly, there's been biological opinions on the effect of the Federal Columbia River Power System on the threatened and endangered salmon of the basin in 2000 and 2004 and 2008 due to, there have been several because of remands by the federal judge. And there's a lot of information at this website, www.salmonrecovery.gov, on those recommendations and the implementation process. But there are other Corps of Engineers restoration authorities in the estuary as well. So we're not only looking at salmon. People are looking at white-tailed deer. They're looking at waterfowl. And then there are many levels of effort, whether it's state, private, or non-governmental organizations, and even smaller mitigation projects for local authorities. So in the end, what we're dealing with, and I'm sorry you can't read this, this is really just meant to illustrate that every one of these little tags is a separate restoration project in the estuary. So the question that we are asking with this study is, how do we implement and assess restoration in a complex system that is also understudied? So how can we do that in a responsible manner when you have multiple agencies and NGOs involved? You've got goals that range from the species to the ecosystem, a variety of restoration methods, ecological gradients both up the river longitudinally and latitudinally between the main stem and the floodplain, and uncertain ecological relationships. There's basic information that's unknown, and interlocked human communities along the way. So I'd like to think of this in terms of the accountability when you have billions of dollars of money being spent on estuary restoration and riverine restoration. How do, in this case, the action agencies under the biological opinions, which are Bonneville Power Administration and the Corps of Engineers, how do they account to the National Marine Fisheries Service for the effects of that those public funds? And how do the actual implementers on the ground account to their funders and sponsors? How do agencies and NGOs account to stakeholders, et cetera? So there's this chain of accountability. And very often, the quantitative assessment and reporting has been found lacking in studies by the National Research Council on ecological restoration efforts. So in the Columbia River estuary, there's actually this federal program of the action agencies in response to the biological opinion. And that is guided by this plan, the Research Monitoring and Evaluation Plan, which is also available on salmonrecovery.gov. And the goal of the program, as you see here, is to understand, conserve, and restore the estuary ecosystem to improve the performance of listed salmonid populations. The specific objectives of this plan include status and trends monitoring to track the status and trends of the resource, action effectiveness monitoring and research, critical uncertainties research, and specific implementation and compliance monitoring, and synthesis and evaluation. And today, the remainder of this talk, I'm going to focus on these two that are highlighted in orange, the monitoring of restoration projects and specific fundamental research. So I like to put this slide up, and some of these photos up. These just show us arriving at one of our study sites in one of the tidal forested wetlands down there. And because I like to put this up concerning approach because it's very difficult. Approaching the assessment of very large, complex ecosystems like this is not an easy thing to do. And specifically, what this study is doing, what the study that I'm talking about today is addressing one of the RPAs, or reasonable and prudent actions, in the biological opinion. And it's to develop and implement a methodology to estimate the cumulative effects of habitat conservation and restoration projects in terms of cause and effect relationships between controlling factors, structures, and processes that affect salmon habitats and performance. So we call this the cumulative effects study. It's funded by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. And the specific purpose is to standardize methods to evaluate the effectiveness of these hydrological reconnection type restoration projects and the secondary and cumulative effects of these projects at multiple scales. So these are the types of restoration projects that are being undertaken in the estuary. This is a failing single small tide gate underneath a road that's been replaced by a couple of very large culverts to improve the circulation and inundation of the floodplain wetland. And here we have two old-fashioned tide gates that don't allow fish in, that have been replaced with some experimental tide gates with two different experimental tide gates with fish doors and that kind of thing. And then this is a dike breach restoration where at the time of the breaching, the contractor shaved the original piles down to the substrate level, because that's how the original dikes were built along the Columbia. Is they would install two rows of pilings and then fill them up with logs and boulders and whatnot. And so at the time of the dike removal, the contractor shaved it down at the substrate level, and 2 years later, this was the effect actually of the hydrological processes on that dike breach. So again, what the efforts are generally down on the Columbia is to restore lateral connectivity, to bring that hydrograph of the river that's a combination of the tidal processes and the Columbia River Basin processes, to bring that back out onto the floodplain to change the actual plant communities and habitat functions that are out on that floodplain. Cumulative effects, the concept came into popular use with the National Environmental Policy Act, NEPA, and it was specifically required that implementers or agencies implementing any kind of change to the ecosystem evaluate what the negative impacts on that system were going to be. And so when we originally started this project, we thought that what we proposed is that we were going to go out, and this is in 2004, and research, do a literature review, and find out how this was being done in all the different fields, how these cumulative effects assessments were being done, and then reverse engineer that and apply it to assessing large-scale effects of restoration. But when we did our literature review in a variety of fields, what we found was that typically the NEPA reviews are not including comprehensive cumulative effects assessments that include, for example, synergistic effects. So the project ended up a little bit harder than we thought. We needed to actually develop a method and search a little bit more widely to bring something up off the ground. So what we ended up settling on was a levels of evidence approach, which is a more recent incarnation of a weight of evidence approach that comes out of medical sciences and ecotoxicology. And so this is the approach that was used, for example, by the Surgeon General's office to determine that cigarette smoking is harmful to your health. So it's taking a meta-analysis of a wide variety of studies and looking at whether the overall evidence would convince a reasonable person of that effect. So this flowchart here shows the process that we've developed that follows essentially a critical thinking train here along the left, from summarizing data, analyzing the data, synthesizing and evaluating it, and then applying it. And where we started was with our hypotheses about site-scale structures and processes, the effects that these restoration actions would have on site-scale structures and processes, as well as landscape-scale processes. And then what types of measured, monitored indicators we would need to measure those, and what we would need to derive further from those indicators, and the types of data we'd need to collect, and the types of analyses that we'd need to implement. And I'm going to talk about each of these in turn here. So the analysis of ecological relationships, the fundamental relationships, like what elevation do you need to produce a given plant community under a different hydrological regime. This is the meta-analysis of monitoring data from specific restoration projects. the GIS analysis of net ecosystem impact, and I'll cover that more, and then the analysis of synergies, spatial and temporal synergies, and then bringing those lines of evidence together to look at the cumulative effects of this large restoration program and applying it full scale in an adaptive management program so that the lessons learned go into the design of new projects as well as the evaluation of old and new management interpretation or action on old projects. So, and I just wanted to point out that this is a good book by edited by Baird and Burton that came out of a Pelston workshop that brought together the Society of Ecotoxicology with the Ecological Society of America, and they specifically focus on this approach. And then this is a more recent book by Downs et al., who are Australian scientists who applied that approach in river systems. So the first step that we took was utilizing a conceptual model to help to identify the indicators that would need to be monitored based on the predicted effects of restoration actions. So the simple form of this conceptual model is that you have man-made stressors, so say the dams or the dikes, and these are acting on controlling factors, which might be light or sediment processes, and then affecting the ecosystem structures, so your plant communities and your process, and ultimately in this case, what we're looking at is the functions for the salmonids, for the outmigrating juvenile salmonids. But even though that is the focus of much of the action agency's work on the Columbia, they're also taking an ecosystem approach. It's explicitly encoded in that research monitoring and evaluation plan that essentially there's a belief that restoring the ecosystem itself and the ecosystem structures and processes will, in fact, help the salmon as opposed to necessarily doing specific salmon-targeted creation projects, for example. So the thought process that we went through in applying this conceptual model to the selection of indicators was to first look at the different measures that were being taken and then to think about what the direct effects of those might be, and then indirect or long-term effects, potential cumulative effects, and then how those might affect the salmon in terms of their opportunity to access the habitat, the capacity of that habitat to support them. And these concepts come from that Simon Stad and Cordell paper in 2002 on the salmon habitat opportunity, capacity, and realized function of Northwest ecosystems. So based on that thought process, we convened a meeting. We invited all the known estuary restoration project managers to a meeting in 2004, and this was facilitated by the Lower Columbia River Estuary Partnership and in Portland. And the goal was to come together on a systematic set of monitoring protocols that everybody could put in place so that ultimately there would be a data set created that could be analyzed, a single unified data set. And so in order to try to track long-term trends into the past, we wanted to make sure that that any protocols we recommended or indicators even were consistent with what people had done previously, whether on restoration projects or in agency monitoring of ecosystem status and trends. But we also wanted to make sure that the best possible techniques were utilized for the future, since we expect this to be going on. And then we understood that they needed to be cost-effective because restoration projects typically are underfunded, and we wanted to make sure that these protocols got used. So we produced a draft in 2005 of these protocols, and from 2005 to 2008, both our team and a number of other restoration project implementers tested the protocols, and we had a second meeting to collect data from feedback from those tests in 2007, and then produced another draft in 2008, and this has just come out in February as a NOAA tech memo, the protocols for monitoring habitat restoration projects in the Lower Columbia River and estuary. So we're really happy about the process that led to those protocols and the consensus and collaboration that went into them. The authors include people from my lab, PNNL, and NOAA, and the Columbia River Estuary Study Task Force, and the UW, in fact. So, and we are seeing that those are being used, actually, on restoration projects in the estuary, and what they're working on now is including that in the contracts, for those of you policy people, is making sure that when a restoration project is contracted out, use of the protocols is actually required. Okay, so that covers the core indicators. So those indicators that we think are going to help track change after restoration based on the types of interventions that are being made and that we think can be cost-effectively monitored at most projects. But in order to look at actual cumulative effects on the ecosystem, we felt that additional indicators needed to be monitored in an intensive manner, so not at every project, not in an extensive manner, but in an intensive manner on some projects. And those would be, there, it's been proposed by Sherwood et al. In 1990 that there's been a fundamental shift in the food web because of the dams, that it's shifted from emergent plant input-based to phytoplankton input-based. And so one of those cumulative effects indicators that we're monitoring currently is macrodetritus, as well as prey production and export, so the prey that are associated with that macrodetritus, the detritivores. Secondly, the availability of connected channel edge as a nexus of terrestrial and aquatic productivity. And then finally, just simply the wetted area, which is not as simple as it sometimes seems, and I'll talk about that more in a moment. And so those are some of the three key indicators of cumulative effects that we're monitoring further, in addition to what we're recommending that people do throughout the estuary. Now, getting back to those four analytical modes from the flowchart that I talked about for assessing cumulative effects in a levels of evidence approach, the first one that we've done is to put together a base model in GIS of the whole estuary study area, in which we've divided it into about 60 management units, and within that about 2,600 site units, or 2,300 site units based on hydrologic delineations. And the idea with this came out in Thom et al. In 2005, and it's an additive approach to assessing change. So it's a very simple model. It's, for example, saying, well, we've added 50 acres here and 50 acres here and 50 acres here, so we have 150 acres of new wetted area, or doing the same thing with any other metric that's being measured out there. So this is an additive approach to being able to simply do bookkeeping about the habitat restoration effort, this large-scale multi-agency effort. Secondly, we're starting to investigate the synergies between projects. So this is the time crowding and space crowding that has been identified by the President's Council on Environmental Quality as one of the places where we do see cumulative effects or synergies actually occur. And so we're doing a time series of accidental breaches or intentional breaches that are very old, and looking at a suite of dike breaches to look at spatial effects, a suite of tide gate replacements to look at those effects. And this is complicated by the fact that they're trying to preserve the white-tailed deer at this area, so it's a very interesting project because they're trying to do work for an endangered terrestrial mammal as well as improve habitat for the fish. So, for example, with these natural dike breaches, we've done a reconnaissance survey in the literature and with old aerial photos and just talking to people to find out where accidental dike breaches are known to have happened. And last year, the purpose of this, of course, is that our study is a 6-year study, and yet we want to be able to predict outcomes 10, 20, 30 years in the future. So we needed to go out and look at some of these places that had been breached a long time ago to see what they look like today. And unfortunately, I can't produce all the data on this right now for you because we've just started. We've done 3 sites last summer, and we're going to finish this summer and work it up. But they do look promising. They look good. They, you know, at a gut level, they look like marshes. So we're happy, we're optimistic because of that, based on our rapid assessment that we did last summer. So then a third line of evidence concerns the statistical test that we've developed with John Skowski here at the U for the hypothetical responses to space crowding. So this is cluster size of restoration projects as the independent variable affecting just any mean response per project. And then the size of the restoration area, so the old hypothesis that the bigger the restoration area, the greater effect. And this is these are all hypothetical, of course. These are not real data. And this is the concept that one restoration project's response here on the y-axis might be increased by the addition by implementing a second restoration project next to it or a third restoration project next to it in close proximity. And so we're working on this, testing these primarily using hydrodynamic models, because it's very difficult to sort of play God in the estuary and set up all the restoration projects that we'd like to. So to look at the effectiveness of some of these restoration actions, another line of evidence that we're using is paired restoration and reference sites. And I'm going to talk a lot more about this in the third section of the talk, but just to give a general study design here, this is a swamp reference site and restoration area, and then a marsh reference site and restoration area on the lower part of the estuary. And we're looking at these two areas. There are tide gate replacements, culvert replacements, and dike breaches that we're looking at. And we're doing both the core and the cumulative effects indicators there. We're measuring all of those with the interagency team. So we started in 2005 collecting baseline data before all these actions were implemented, and our final year of data collection will be actually this summer. So this is ongoing research. And the kinds of results that we're seeing from this, for example, we're looking at similarity indices between plant cover on the reference and restoration sites to see if they are trending towards each other and if the rates of that trend are different between, for example, the forested wetlands and the marshes. And this kind of information on organic matter export, particularly vegetation elevation relationships, really inform design of new projects as much as they do assessment. So the overarching sort of guiding conceptual effort here, or statistical effort here, is that we have a working hypothesis concerning the collective effects of these restoration projects on the ecosystem and then the ecosystem support for the salmon. And our different indicators represent different sub-hypotheses, and this is meant to represent the idea that if you test one of the hypotheses and it turns out not to support the overall working hypothesis, then that leads to this sort of lack of support box. And if it turns out to support the working hypothesis, then it's coming back in here. So this is basically a hypothetico-deductive method. We're applying that in this levels of evidence effort. So we're looking at the expected changes that we've developed through this conceptual model analysis, like return of marsh macrodetritus to the system and decrease in fragmentation, and testing those as individual hypotheses and looking to see whether or not the preponderance of evidence would support the conclusion, would convince a reasonable person of the conclusion that overall this program is in fact improving ecosystem processes and support for salmon. And so the causal criteria, and these come from the levels of evidence approach, are what we're using then to evaluate each of those hypotheses. So they are, for example, and these are from both of the books that I cited before, they're listed, the strength of association in cause and effect, consistency of it, specificity of it, the temporality, whether biological and ecological gradients exist and are plausible based on the literature and what we know, the state of the science. Experimental evidence, which is much less frequent in restoration ecology than it is in the fields from which this method was developed in medicine and epidemiology, and overall just whether it's plausible. So this levels of evidence approach is using correlated data to make the case for causal inference and against alternative hypotheses. And this, probably any of you studying restoration ecology have seen, this is adapted from the late Dr. Bradshaw in England, whose work was in mine reclamation. And this graph has been adapted by many people since, including my supervisor, Ron Thom. And it's simply showing some sort of correlation between site structure and function during the development of the site after some sort of intervention, whether it's a natural disturbance or a man-made stressor or a restoration action. And so we're testing these hypotheses at various points in the restoration trajectory based on the data that's being collected, the monitoring data that's being collected on these projects. So in summary of the levels of evidence approach, then we're bringing together an additive-based model, which is sort of something we can hang our hat on, even if we don't show any synergies, together with very focused hydrodynamic modeling to look for synergies in space and time. And then the fundamental ecological data that we're collecting both on restoration and reference sites to try to understand these basic relationships and improve the design of new restoration projects as well as their assessment. So in this third section of the talk then, I'm going to focus on a specific set of restoration and reference sites and talk about some of the things that we can learn from those. So specifically asking, how can we use ecological research at these sites to identify the controlling factors on the system and to identify what the most achievable restoration targets are on projects in the for projects in the area, as well as appropriate monitoring indicators to assess those. So down in the Grays River in southwest Washington along the Columbia, this is a tributary to the Columbia. It comes in at Grays Bay near Nozzle. We've been working for several years now on these reference sites at Secret River, Crooked Creek, and what we call the Seal Slough Reference. And these are tidal forested wetlands dominated by Sitka spruce, Picea sitchensis. And comparing those to a restoration site here, as well as actually a more recent one down here and one on the adjacent river, Deep River. And this shows some of the interventions that have been made here. So we have dike breaches along here and a large culvert replacement here. There are no tie gate replacements at this specific site. So first of all, at the reach scale, the hypothesis, and this comes from my dissertation, was that the development of the Picea sitchensis freshwater tidal forested wetland channels incorporates large woody debris to form a low gradient step pool system. And the way that this came about was pretty simple. I was studying fluvial geomorphology over in the Department of Earth and Space Sciences simultaneous to working out in these swamps, and it looked like a step pool system, a classic mountain step pool system. And but there wasn't any classification system available for these types of tidal channels. So I just simply went out and did longitudinal surveys and photo documentation of channels in these three forested wetlands. And there was no significant difference in a Kruskal-Wallace test between the three forested wetlands in the inner pool distance. So they were very similar, and in fact, the 2.3 channel widths per pool, which is the conventional non-dimensional unit that's used for channel widths, fell right into the category that had been previously identified as typical of step pool systems in mountain streams. And the citation for that is there. It was in Oregon coastal mountain streams. In addition, just the observed sequence of pools and log jams was clearly a step pool type of sequence. So each of these triangles here is a log jam, and each of these circles is a pool, and then the substrate level is shown in the gray line between them. So this paper just came out on extending the Montgomery and Buffington classification system from the mountain areas where it was developed down toward these areas sort of between a classic estuary and a forest. That's one of the interesting things about this study area is I think that it's historically been left out by a lot of estuarine ecologists because it's forested, and it's probably been left out by a lot of foresters because it's wet. So it's a very interesting transitional area, and there's a lot of research that can be done there, and I would encourage people to think about working in these systems if you're designing a research project. So now to move from the reach scale to the catchment scale. And I know you just had a talk from Greg Hood a few weeks ago, so you probably heard a lot about hydraulic geometry. But I just want to actually give a quick background before talking about what we did with hydraulic geometry down in this Grays River area. So first of all, back in the 30s and 40s, the engineers who were working on tidal inlet stability research for navigation found that there was a correlation that cross-sectional geometry was dependent on the catchment area there. And then later on, you had Leopold and Maddock and Myrick and Leopold working in fluvial systems and showing similar relationships that cross-sectional geometry was a function of discharge. And then, more recently, in restoration ecology, you've had people using surrogates for Q and showing that there are that Q, which in some cases, for example, when it's bidirectional flow, is more difficult to measure, can also be replaced with tidal prism, catchment area, and total length of tidal channels in that relationship. So in other words, that the cross-sectional area at the outlet is going to be dependent on any one of those metrics. And that's been clearly shown in many more studies than this. So what we hypothesize as a null hypothesis is essentially that there was no such relationship in the system. So that cross-sectional area at outlet wasn't dependent on catchment area or total length of channels. And furthermore, that those two things were not related. And there's also been a debate in the literature in the last few years in estuaries and coasts that you might have heard about from Greg concerning the ability to take these relationships and extrapolate them from region to region. And so we wanted to at least make a stab at looking at whether or not any relationships that we did find here in our region were similar to anything that's been found anywhere else in the world. So our approach was to do a lot of cross-section surveys, surveying the cross-sections at the outlets, and then to do some GIS work with LIDAR data. And this was not a conventional approach because this very fine-grained topography of the floodplain is hard to get at using conventional approaches for high-relief areas. So we used a method by Tarbatten to derive the catchment boundaries, and then we went out and ground-truthed it on transects to make sure we were kind of getting at what was really going on out there. And we also did a roughness analysis. And unfortunately, we only had three of these remnant swamps to work with. So we have, our graphs are sparse with only 3 points, but these are the correlations for, this is the effect of catchment area on cross-sectional area at outlet, and then the effect of catchment area on channel length and channel length on cross-sectional area outlet. And then we further took these 3 points for each of these relationships and put them into the only sets of data that could be found that were people that actually published their data on the effect of catchment area here on cross-sectional area at outlet and then catchment area on channel length. And so I went ahead and just put the three Pacific Northwest swamps are located here, these stars, and here they have more catchment area than this study and here. So this isn't, obviously there aren't 100 points here, we can't say something really strong statistically, but they are within the data cloud, which is an interesting finding. And these are, sorry I didn't mention, this is the San Francisco Bay Delta, and this is the salt marshes of the UK, the United Kingdom. And what's interesting about that, in my mind, is that these are places that are strongly, the hydrology is strongly dominated by the tides. They're flat, they're floodplains. Whereas what we were looking at, as you saw, were real watersheds. So we have a tidal system and a watershed, and yet the relationships are somewhat similar despite that. So one of the really difficult challenges of working in this area is that you have tributary flow, you have main stem flow, and you have the tides. So the hydrograph becomes very complicated. So then we wanted to look at what this information from the reference sites really means for restoration design and assessment. So for example, comparing pre versus post restoration conditions, we wanted to ask on the restoration sites, is large wood there? Is it forcing pools? And after restoration, is hydraulic geometry, are those relationships trending towards what we see, the regression lines that we see in the swamps? And then are sediment accretion rates being changed, first by the diking in the late 1800s, and then second by opening up those dikes and restoring the hydrological connection? So in other words, is the land elevation being affected by the changes in sedimentary processes? So clearly, out on the restoration sites reaches here, we're not seeing very many pools. This is showing the pools per 100 meters, I think. Yeah, pools per 100 meters. and compared to the tidal forested wetlands. And the pools that we do see out there are mainly either cow crossings, or they're the point where a road is stopping flow, or they're a beaver dam. And there are a few of those beaver dams, which incidentally were broken up immediately after the hydrology was reconnected. The force, they couldn't withstand that force. And interesting, though, while there were no significant accumulations of large wood on these typical dairy lands, there was recruitment of wood after the hydrological reconnection actions. So we saw some of these remnant stands of wood that, actually, they weren't remnant stands, that's incorrect. They were trees that had started to grow in the altered hydrologic conditions on these dairy lands because they weren't inundated as much. And so they could not withstand the opening of the dikes, and so they started to fall because they were drowned, essentially. So we started to see some recruitment of these trees into the channels on the restoration sites, as well as, interestingly, some legacy wood that was becoming exposed in these channels, like you see here, by the changes in the channel morphology after the flow was increased. Now, another interesting puzzle that presented itself is that what you see here is the catchment area versus cross-sectional area at outlet. And you see the before condition for these restoration sites, and you see them moving across, or in this case, substantially away from the regression line from the swamps. And so we had to ask, you know, how good is our reference site data if our restoration sites are moving away from that so radically? And we did a lot of work to try to answer that question. I think we have. This is what I showed before of the typical massive effect in the first few years after these dike breaches. And this is just examples of many of the cross sections that we surveyed. But what we found through the LIDAR work, as well as our topographic surveys on the ground, is that the mean elevation of the restoration site, which is here adjacent to this reference site, this swamp, was 2.2 meters, whereas the mean elevation of the adjacent reference site was 2.9 meters. So there was a 0.7 meter difference in the mean elevation. And furthermore, the roughness, we developed a roughness index, which is not a typical vegetation roughness index. This is a microtopographic roughness index. And the swamp area is substantially rougher on the ground in terms of microtopography. It has that classic swamp hummocky nature. And so it's actually affecting the distribution of flow and holding of flow with that hummocky microtopography. And then the final piece of evidence that we had was that the using some radiocarbon dating work, which I don't have time to explain all the methods, but the sediment deposition on the site had decreased during the time of diking, and then it began to increase. It's at about 2.4 centimeters per year right now, so we're seeing a substantial deposition because these areas are so much lower. And so the reason, we think, for the movement away from the regression line is that essentially these areas, have become basins that are larger. This is a larger basin that can hold a larger tidal prism or volume of water than the adjacent reference site. So until the sediment accretion rate catches that land elevation up to what the reference site has, and until the recruitment of wood makes it hummocky, brings the microtopography back, we're going to be seeing a need for a much greater cross-sectional area at the outlet to accommodate the flows that are moving onto and off of this site every day. So this is just showing the area time inundation index that we developed to contrast what's going on here, and showing that at Candle Farm, it was 34% compared to 9% at the reference site, and the frequency of the inundation was 54% compared to 18% at the reference. And this just shows the typical movement of water onto the reference site, which happens usually at least once a day. And this shows the how much area is inundated for a given water elevation out in the channel. And you can see how different it is between the farm and the reference. It doesn't take much water to get that farm wet. So in summary, we've been using these the study of these reference sites to clarify the restoration targets and to help devise better methods to assess and both assess and design the projects. So the in terms of a restoration target, one example would be the number of pools that we saw in the swamp systems. And in terms of design, things like these regression relationships can be used provisionally, based on what I just explained, to look at what the cross-sectional area at outlet should be. And this illustrates overall the way that we're using reference sites, which is basically a control chart method. So by sampling a series of reference sites over time, you establish the background variability here, this sort of band of potential condition, no matter what your response variable is. And the idea is that your restoration site is eventually going to move somewhere up within this band. It's going to start to follow some of the patterns of background variability and start to behave somewhat like somewhere within the range of the suite of reference sites that's out there. And so in a separate project, we're establishing that suite of reference sites throughout the estuary. And this is a Bonneville Power Administration funded project. And the data is going to start being available next year so that restoration project managers can compare their restoration project to the reference sites that we're collecting data with the protocols on so that to evaluate their restoration success. So we can identify controlling factors from reference sites that are subject to existing conditions. We can inform our site scale designs by catchment scale and reach scale data. And we've found that large woody debris is, in fact, important in tidal systems, but we may need to start considering active restoration techniques instead of the passive ones that are currently being used to bring large woody debris to those sites, and possibly even to change the land elevation, because based on the current sedimentation rates, it would take 20 to 50 years just for the land elevation on those sites to be suitable for a spruce swamp. So depending on the restoration trajectory that managers are looking for, they may want to do some active intervention. Additionally, in terms of the selection of indicators, we found that the channel networks are virtually unchanged behind the dikes in the areas that we're looking at. So channel density is going to change instantaneously and then be done for the most part. So while channel density was thought to be to have a lot of potential as an indicator, it's really not something that's going to be tracking change for us. And furthermore, with the inundated area, a lot of the agencies, they simply want their implementers to report to them that they restored 50 hectares this year. Well, if they restored 50 hectares of inundated area in 2009, in 50 years, that's going to be a lot smaller number, because that inundated area is probably going to be, the elevation there is probably going to be increasing. So we are finishing our project in 2011, and people are going to be reporting, the action agencies are going to be reporting to NOAA in 2013 and 2017, and using this concept of asking whether the preponderance of evidence from all these lines of evidence is actually suggesting that measurable change has been achieved. And if so, whether that's actually being overwhelmed by continuing land conversion. What steps are necessary to achieve greater effectiveness in habitats, and what suite of projects produces the most significant return of these valued functions? These are the kinds of questions that we want to be using these lines of evidence to answer in these various reporting processes. So I'd like to particularly just thank my colleagues from the University of Washington and my advisor here, Christina Vogt, and the other colleagues from NOAA, Pacific Northwest National Lab, and the Columbia River Estuary Study Task Force. Thank you.
Question?
Yes.
You talked about, if you say now when we restore 50 hectares, mm-hmm. in 30 years that would be a smaller area. Will it be a more functional area? So is it really a loss?
Right.
You want to repeat the question?
Yes, she's asking, I think, if I understand correctly, whether in fact that, say, let's say it moves from 50 hectares now of inundated area, of consistently inundated area, wetland, down to say 30 hectares over time as sediment accretes. then is that 20 hectares lost? Is that your question? Is the difference lost?
Is it really a loss to the system, or
right.
is it increasing in its ecological functionality even as the actual area is?
Well, I certainly think that you're right, that it is, because it's connected and because it's not being adversely affected by stressors, that it certainly is contributing more. And that's a very good point, that perhaps the accounting that I'm talking about should separate wetland area from non-wetland area in terms of the restoration effort.
Okay, so we're out of time, so if you want to go to Iowa.